Yeah, I heard there's yoga class going on this morning.
Yeah, whatever.
You're not going?
Not doing that.
Team bonding.
Yeah, okay. Right. Dan Shulman's skipping as well. I don't feel so bad.
Well, he's more important than you.
That is definitely the case.
This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and producing back in Bristol, Troy Farkas. Lots and lots of press conferences and news on Monday as teams who aren't playing in the World Series get stuff done with the permission of Major League Baseball. The Pirates fired Executive Vice President and General Manager Neil Huntington, and they formally named ex-Penguin COO Travis Williams as the team president. So they are moving forward. We'll be talking with Tim Kirkchin about that decision and maybe some ripple effects on their roster. The Padres formally announced that Jace Tingler will be their manager. He'll be introduced at a press conference the day after the World Series in San Diego. The Yankees fired pitching coach Larry Rothschild. He served as the pitching coach since 2011. And there's already a lot of speculation that Larry is going to wind up being the pitching coach because that's where Joe Girardi was introduced on Monday as the Phillies manager. Joe Girardi and Rothschild, of course, worked for many years together on the Yankee staff. Here's Matt Klentak, the Phillies general manager, talking about why Joe Girardi was hired.
It is time to win. No questions asked. It is time to win right now. That lends itself to bringing in a guy who has done that, who has won in the toughest of markets with the pressures and has hoisted that World Series trophy over his head. Again, I think that's all what led us to Joe, but I think that is by and large why we place such a premium on the prior experience.
I think the great question about Girardi is what did he learn about his exit from the Yankees? And he sort of addressed that.
It is good to take a step back because I think you see the game from different perspectives and you're able to learn under situations where you're not pressured to win every day. But also to reevaluate the importance it is to the fans, because sometimes when you're involved in it every day, you can kind of lose perspective and you're worried about your job on a day in and day out basis. And you don't always see it from the fans' perspective. And I think that was important that I got a chance to see that again.
Cubs manager David Ross was introduced on Monday, and he talked about how you can't cling to those memories of 2016.
It's not about 2016. It's the expectation of winning. It's about winning championships. It's about holding yourself accountable to the things that you've found in winning. You have that experience. Let's emphasize those. Let's hold each other to a high standard because I want to win a championship. I want to win multiple championships. I want to bring championships back to Chicago. And we've done that before. I've done that in another city. And I know what that looks like. And when you see the opposite, and I've been on some losing teams, when you see the opposite, you got to call it out as soon as possible.
Cubs president Theo Epstein talked about David Ross and made very clear he's going to make his own decisions.
If you're a front office and you want a puppet, you don't hire David Ross. Anyone who knows Rossi knows that. He is absolutely his own man. I think his teammates knew that when he was playing. We knew it in the front office. He's been that way as a special assistant and really proud and looking forward to partner with him. But I don't expect a yes man in the least. I'm looking forward to someone with his own ideas, especially, you know, strong conviction about winning and what winning looks like and how to build it. And it's not always going to be what we agree with. But I think it is going to lead to conversations that makes us all better as an organization.
For the Nationals and Astros, Monday was a travel day leading up to Game 6 of the World Series. Tonight, Dave Martinez, Nationals manager, spoke from Washington before his team traveled to Houston, and he talked about how you can't count out the Nationals in a game in which Steven Strasburg starts.
We got Steven Strasburg on the mound, who's been unbelievable for us this year. So the guys feel good. We were talking last night after a press conference, and they're all upbeat. They don't think that this is way far from over. Like I said, we're going to regress, ready to get ready to play tomorrow and win tomorrow.
Strasburg lined up to start against Justin Verlander tonight in Game 6 in Houston. Dave Martinez was asked about Game 7 if Max Scherzer can't make the start.
Right now, my focus is on Game 6. We got to treat that as Game 7 right now. There won't be a Game 7 if we can't get out of Game 6. So I'm focused on just winning tomorrow, going 1-0, and go from there.
Astros manager A.J. Hinch talked about his confidence level in Verlander.
Our confidence is great. I mean, we believe he's going to be at his best tomorrow. He loves this big stage. He loves being relied upon. Like his preparation, I mean, he's going to be as intense as he's been probably the entire season because he knows what can happen at the end of 27 outs. You know, when Justin's pitching, you know, we come to the ballpark with an absolute expectation to win.
Hinch talked about his team having World Series experience.
I'm even more calmer in the moment now, you know, in 2019 than I was 2017. Now, to been there, done that part of this, I think is very important for us. It's the, when you do play the experience card is when you're under the most stress. And I would tell you game sixes and sevens are in the World Series is high stress. And I love that about our team is behaving the same way, or, you know, hopefully me and the coaching staff are as well. But this is where you lean on experience.
After game five, there's a lot of talk about the computer-generated strike zone and whether it's time for baseball to adopt that. And A.J. Hinch was asked about that.
I think it's a little naive to think that simply letting computers generate strike or ball or, you know, the safe out part, the replay that we have. Be careful what you wish for. Always seek to improve the game. And if we can better the game, I'm all for it. And perhaps that's an avenue that we're going to go down someday. But I love people. So I'm a people person by nature, anybody that knows me. So I want to keep as many people in the game and in control of the game as we can.
Jessica Mendoza was on Get Up, and she has stronger feelings about it than AJ does.
I mean, honestly, take the human element out of it, because umpires are going to make mistakes. That's going to happen. And my whole thing is like, what are we still doing? This is 2019. We know, but we have the K-zone right there. Tells us balls and strikes. Let's take that out of it. And I'm defending the hitters. I'm like, you know what? Like, that call was a ball, and now you're sitting down. Like, Victor Robles, there's a reason he chucked his helmet.
Yeah, CeCe Sabathia was also on Get Up with Jessica, and she that's the way he feels. He's ready for the electronic strike zone. I'll be asking Tim Kirchin about the electronic strike zone coming up. But before that, we all know that hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskiewicz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. That's ZipRecruiter.com/B-U-S-T-E-R. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Team heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirchin on Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirchin covers baseball for ESPN, and I've been getting asked the question a lot, Tim. Do you want the game over, do you want the World Series over tonight in Game 6, or do you want it to go through Game 7? And I know your answer to that question. You want it over as soon as possible because you're sick of me yelling at you in the pregame show on ESPN Radio.
Yes, I'm sick of you yelling at me, period. Number two, I am hoping we go game 7 because as baseball writers, we know what the old adage is. If we're going to go 6, meaning get on a plane and go someplace for game 6, then we have to have a game 7 to make it completely worth getting back on a plane and flying across the country again. It requires 6 and 7. That's the way I look at it.
Do you have a gut feel for tonight's game?
No, this series has not provided any gut feeling for me. I picked the Astros in 7 from the beginning, so I don't know what to say about that. I just know this hasn't followed the script at all. I could see Justin Verlander coming out and dominating tonight and winning his first World Series game, and yet the second best starting pitcher in this postseason is Steven Strasburg. I could see him dialing up a gem and we go to a game 7. So no, this series has not allowed us to have any feel because so many people, including me, have been so wrong most of the way.
Yeah, in terms of game to game predictions, conventional wisdom is batting 200, 1 for 5 in terms of how it's played out. I do think that the question of Justin Verlander in the first inning, that is real. A 16.23 ERA in the postseason in the first inning, like a lot of dominant power pitchers, Tim, it seems like if you're going to get to him, you're going to get to him in the first inning.
Right, because his ERA buster in every other inning other than the first inning is 1.78 this year. That's this postseason. That doesn't follow at all. But just look at the first inning from game two. He walked Trey Turner on four pitches to start the game. Third time he's ever walked a leadoff guy of a game on four pitches. Then he threw a terrible 0-2 changeup to Anthony Rendon. So he made some bad pitches. He got himself in trouble. And that, of course, is what he has to now prevent, is no trouble in the first inning. Because if you give the Nationals a little hope, we've seen in this series, they can go a long way.
What's your sense of Max Scherzer and your gut instinct on whether or not he would pitch a Game 7 if it's necessary?
Well, I heard something last night, Buster. And again, I can't even report it. But my guess is Max Scherzer is not going to pitch in Game 7. Now, I can't say that for sure, but my guess is this is a debilitating situation when you have what he has. Mark Teixeira told us that's a 2-3-4-day situation where you can't do anything when you get a neck and back spasm like that. So if it's 4 days, he's not pitching in Game 7. So my guess is if the Nationals get there, my guess is someone other than Max Scherzer is going to pitch that game.
And that, of course, would be Anibal Sanchez and a whole host of relievers after that with all hands on deck in a Game 7. A lot of discussion, Tim, out of Game 5 about the electronic strike zone. And I got to tell you, I've been in favor of it, and that just reinforced the reasons why for me, because I hate it when decisions without factual support affect outcomes. I hate the idea that Nationals fans left the ballpark the other night wondering what could have been, because it was clear that that ball four that to Victor Robles was called a strike, that was out of the zone. And there would have been a moment when the Nationals would have brought the tying run to the plate against Gerrit Cole. And, you know, as good as Gerrit Cole is, he probably would have gotten the next hitter out. But I hate the doubt that lingers in the mind. And maybe the best example of that, 1985 World Series, Don Dankinger calls a base runner safe at first base. The World Series turns at that point. You have Cardinals fans going to their graves believing that they would have won the World Series otherwise, that they would have been the champions that season. And I hate that. And baseball fixed that problem with calls at first base. And I think it's inevitable that they will fix the situation with balls and strikes, and they will go to an electronic strike zone. While there might be some questions about that, at least there will be, there won't be the concern about serendipity, about subjectivity with home plate umpires. What's your take?
Yeah, my take is I've been against an electronic strike zone all along. And of course, let's not compare the Dankinger play to missing a strike on 2 inches off the plate. There's a big difference there, but it's the same idea, Buster. Everybody is talking about this after a game, and that's why a change, I believe, has to be made eventually, because this is all we're talking about is a Lance Barksdale's strike zone instead of the baseball game that we watched. And since the technology shows us on TV and every other website showing you this is a ball, this is a strike, since everyone has this information, and we might as well use it somehow, because when the fans are in on it, and you're right, they're filing out saying, you know, the umpire lost the game for us, which clearly he did not. But if that's the perception, and that's what everyone is talking about, and that's what the column is the next day, then I think we need to really look into doing something about this.
David Ross was introduced as the Cubs manager yesterday. He talked about wanting to be a manager for a long time.
Had an eye on this my entire career. Guys have said that I'd fit this role. Super excited about being in this role. Last 3 years, you know, my name's been thrown around a lot in the managerial ring, and took those 3 years to prepare for this moment. I'm super excited about it. I've been a part of a lot of winning teams. I know what winning looks like. There's things that are going to expect out of the players, out of myself, that entail winning. Some of those things come with respect, trust, commitment, effort, hard work, and accountability. These things are important to me. My players can expect that from me, and I will expect that from them.
Tim, what's his biggest challenge as he takes over as the Cubs manager?
Well, I think it's, Buster, that he has worked with these guys before and been teammates with them, and he's beloved by them and vice versa. That's going to be the biggest challenge. But I think he's going to be able to get through that because they all know who David Ross was as a player. And he was indeed a joyful, playful, energetic, hilarious guy and a tough-nosed teammate. But the tough-nosed teammate is the most important thing here. They know that when he was an active player, he was the guy that got in somebody's face who wasn't playing the game the right way. He's the guy who went to a star player and said, "You're not playing today because you have a stomachache. What are you doing?" So they saw the real tough side of David Ross. And so if they saw it again just as a manager and said, "Where did that come from?" They know exactly where that comes from. That is the tough guy, David Ross, who showed up once in a while as the backup catcher for the Cubs. That's why I think it's going to work, because even though it's his biggest challenge, now I'm in charge of these guys, not right next to them, I think they're going to all understand, we know who the next manager is. He will get on you if you do something incorrectly.
I think the Cubs, I know this for a fact, the Cubs front office felt like Joe Maddon was exactly the right guy at exactly the right time when he took over in 2015. Do you feel that that's the case with David Ross in 2020, Tim?
I do, because I think he's so different than what Joe Maddon did. Joe Maddon did a tremendous job with the Cubs, but they had stopped listening to his voice. And now the big question is to me, is that core group of guys who have been together for so long now, unusually long for a major league team, is it time to break up that core of players? Or can David Ross find that core and get it right back to where it was, say, 4 years ago? That's the big question for me. So I think Joe is the perfect answer. They stopped listening to him. And now I think David Ross's voice is going to be the perfect voice for the Cubs.
Joe Girardi was introduced as manager in Philadelphia on Monday. He was asked about his message to the team.
We need to do whatever it takes to win. We have to trust each other. We have to love each other. We have to be accountable to each other. We have to respect each other. And it's our job to do everything we can to win on a daily basis, because there's a lot of people counting on us. But there's also a teammate. There's a little boy and a little girl that go to the ballpark and excited to see you do great things. So let's get it done.
It's interesting because I feel like his biggest challenge, Tim, is so different than David Ross's biggest challenge. And to some degree, it's out of his control. I look at the Cubs team and say, that team's ready to win. I don't know if the Phillies are ready to win. I think they have such a desperate need for pitching that Joe Girardi could come in and be a terrific manager, and it may not make a huge difference in the standings. What do you think?
Well, they have to get that pitching healthy first off, and then they're going to have to add to that pitching. Because I'm with you, Buster. I think we both agree that the Phillies should have won more games over the last 2 years total than they did. But they're not a great team. I mean, you know, they're like 15 games under 500 since August of 2018. This has been a pretty ordinary team. And it's been in part because, you know, David Robertson got hurt and starting pitching got hurt. I mean, that's going to have to change. But they're going to have to go get another pitcher or two if they're going to win in a division that includes the Braves and the Nationals. So they've got some work to do. And I think Joe Girardi's the perfect voice there also. Authoritative voice, militaristic voice at times, and a voice that, you know, you can only take for so long. But it's the right voice now because they need some discipline, and they really need that more than anything. But the only thing they need more than that is pitching, and right now they don't have enough.
They may have a pitching coach in waiting after a decision made by the Yankees over the weekend. They have fired Larry Rothschild as their pitching coach. His situation, Tim, reminds me a lot of Girardi's exit with the Yankees, where it just feels like that, you know what, a lot of time went by and maybe everybody didn't necessarily see eye to eye. Larry is a, you know, terrific pitching coach. He has his long history. We know the Yankees from year to year have become more steeped in analytics. Maybe Larry's not quite as bought in as some of the pitching coaches that are being hired around baseball. And I know that Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, really believes in cross-pollination, where he likes bringing in people from other organizations that have had success and have success implementing analytics and they're just looking for a different voice. What do you think?
Well, that's exactly what this is. Larry Rothschild has done a great job as a pitching coach for a long time, and he will work again as a pitching coach because he knows what he's doing. But you're right. Today's game is not about what happened years ago. It's about adapting to the new analytics, and maybe Larry didn't adapt to that. But mostly it comes back to what we talked about three times now, Buster, on this show. It's all about the voice that you're hearing, and sometimes you just have to change the voice in order to get the best out of the guys. And that's what I think is going to happen here. And my guess is we're going to see more and more younger hitting coaches and pitching coaches, especially from the college ranks and everywhere else, because they have a different look at things. And that really intrigues front office people, general managers, and I don't blame them. But there's no doubt that Larry Rothschild was really good at this and maybe didn't keep up as much with the times. And the Yankees said, all right, someone else has to come in here and try something else.
So back in September, the Pirates announced that Neil Huntington would return as general manager. At the same time, they made the announcement that Clint Hurdle was out. And I got to tell you, that surprised me. And as I talked about in the podcast yesterday, I do feel like that the work that Neil did as general manager of the Pirates has been underrated because of a couple of wild card losses in 2014 to Madison Bumgarner, 2015 to Jake Arrieta. If the Pirates had found their way through those postseasons, they'd gotten to the World Series, then there would be a completely different perspective about what the Pirates have accomplished over the last decade. But I thought when they let Clint Hurdle go, and that eventually we saw team president Frank Coonerly out, that they would let Neil go as well, just to turn things over. Because I think it's pretty clear, based on attendance figures, they have a massive, massive perception problem in Pittsburgh with how fans view that, the ownership and the leadership of the team. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree, Buster. I thought Neil was gone when Clint was gone. They kind of came in together. They've been together a long time. And if you fire one, you got to fire the other. That's what I thought would happen at the time. But I agree with you about the perception problem. I love Pittsburgh. I love going to Pittsburgh. But as I walk the streets of Pittsburgh and meet casual fans, that's all I hear is, when are we going to get some people in charge here who are going to take us in another direction, from ownership to GM and everything else? So now they get their wish. Now they don't get a new owner, but they get a new club president, a new manager, and a new general manager. And Buster, I think it's probably time. Just another case where they need a new look at that team. That team was so bad from, say, the beginning of July on, and they're in a very difficult division now, and they're not getting out of it without a total change here. So that's what they're finally getting in their front office and now on the field for the Pirates.
Yeah, and you now are going to have a front office that's not, closely tied to individual players on that team. We heard last month, for example, that Starling Marte was someone that the Pirates would bring back in 2020. Now you can talk about trading him. There's not a particular allegiance from the front office to a player. You can have a fresh look at things, and maybe some tough decisions that need to be made can be made, in part because the new front office is going to have renewed credibility, or at least a fresh start with fans. So it'll be interesting to see what direction that goes. All right, Tim, any thoughts on Chaim Bloom taking over the Red Sox?
Well, it's just another brilliant young guy who might end up being a real difference maker in another front office in baseball. So let's give him his due that. But let's also understand, Buster, something that you especially have been talking about for a couple weeks now. He walks into an extremely difficult situation. Yes, it's the Red Sox, rich heritage, tremendous amount of money, but he's got to fix the farm system. He's got to figure out Mookie Betts. He's got to figure out J.D. Martinez. He's got to figure out what to do with a starting rotation that seems to be all injured. What's he going to do with all this, and how's he going to do it in a short amount of time? So I'm not sure I see a GM walk into what should be a great situation, but is not as great as it should be given all the elements involved. So good luck. He's got his work cut out for him.
All right, Tim. I'll see you at the park later.
Okay, Buster. Quit yelling at me. See you later.
Numbers game.
Sarah Lang is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And, of course, she joins us all the time here on the podcast. Sarah, we'll start with this. You are Chaim Bloom. You are taking over the Red Sox baseball operations department. You have really, really difficult decisions ahead. Would you trade Mookie Betts this winter, even if the offers give you 70, 80 cents in the dollar?
I don't think the Red Sox should trade Mookie Betts. I think that it seems like they probably will, based on everything we've read, but I think that they should be finding a way to, you know, keep him and find a way to pay him. But, you know, we'll see. Obviously, you know, he is such a well-respected executive, everything that he did down in Tampa. And, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting to think of someone coming from within the division and how he'll approach that and what he'll be thinking. But I would not trade Mookie Betts.
Yeah, and keep in mind, too, that the perception down in Tampa was not, you know, they never adopted the tanking strategy like a lot of the other teams did in the last decade. Their perspective was, you know what, we can find a way. We can go find guys, you know, like my friend Ollie Drake. We can go identify guys that we can win with, you know, and that's on us. And so that's where he's coming from. He's not somebody who's going to immediately say, okay, trade everybody. Let's go through a 5 or 6 year rebuilding period. He's going to have belief that he's going to be able to find some right guys in this situation. But I'm going to throw another curveball at you. What if you're Chaim Bloom and you sit down with Mookie Betts at the beginning of November and you sit down with his agent and Mookie says, you know what, I'm going into free agency next fall. If that's the message you get, then would you trade him?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. But I also think that it's worth taking a really long look at, you know, the finances, which obviously, you know, he has a lot more to work with now than he did in Tampa. And figuring out if they would be able to make, you know, Mookie Betts an offer that would be very competitive within the market. Because you have to imagine that somewhere, somehow, they might be able to. And I do think that he's worth paying one of those kinds of contracts. Obviously, he had a little bit of a down year this year in comparison. But if you look at the kind of player he's been in his career, he certainly seems worth, you know, paying a lot of money, whatever the market is these days, which we've seen kind of change pretty rapidly in the last 3 years. But if he indicates that he's really testing it, then that is where you start considering it. But even still, I think that it's worth trying to figure out, okay, could we pay him? Even if he did that, would we be able to convince him otherwise with a really great offer?
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is plus 16. So the Astros outscored the Nationals by 16 runs in those 3 games in D.C., That plus 16 run differential is tied for the largest by any team in 3 straight games, which were all on the road, within any postseason series ever. So the only other times it happened were the 2008 Rays at the Red Sox in the ALCS, the 1961 Yankees at the Reds in the World Series, and the 1903 Boston Americans at the Pirates, and of course, the very first World Series. So this was something that we had not seen very much, and the Astros did it to get themselves back in and get into the driver's seat in this World Series.
Number two
is one. So in order to have that run differential, the Astros held the Nationals to just one run in each of those 3 games in Washington. That was the first time that the visiting team in the middle 3 games of a 2-3-2 World Series allowed one run or fewer in all 3 contests. And the only other visiting team to post 3 straight road performances allowing one or fewer runs was the 1968 Tigers, who held the Cardinals to one run in games 2, 6, and 7. So it wasn't consecutive in the same way, even though they were consecutive road games. And the Nationals hadn't been held to one or fewer runs in 3 straight home games since 2016. So that was a lot.
Number one
is 5. So this is just the 3rd World Series in which the road team has won each of the first 5 games, joining the Yankees' comeback over the Braves in 1996 and the White Sox upset of the Cubs in 1906. No World Series has seen the road team win each of the first 6 contests, which is what's in play tonight in Houston. And of course, there's never been a World Series where the road team won every game, which is what the Nationals are trying to do if they were still to have hopes to win this World Series. And overall, road teams have won 7 straight World Series games, dating back to game 4 after that 18-inning game last year. That's a record. We had never seen road teams win 7 straight World Series games across seasons.
Yeah, it's been absolutely amazing. Conventional wisdom completely thrown out, I think, during the course of this World Series. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this, and I'll be in contact during the game. I know that.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
When you have a 107-win team down, just like Johnny from The Karate Kid, you got to sweep the leg, baby. You have to finish. You have to go for the jugular.
They just smother the Nationals three nights in a row.
There's a reason why they were the largest favorite in a World Series since 2007.
Yeah, we're going back home, baby. I mean, with the lead, it means a lot.
It's over. It's not even going to go seven. It's going to go six. Verlander's going to win his first World Series game. Game, set, match. Thanks for coming, Nats. Bye-bye.
Chris Singleton has been covering the World Series as the analyst for ESPN Radio alongside play-by-play man Dan Shulman. And Singy, I'm not going to ask you to predict what's going to happen in Game 6 because I think you'd agree with me. Like, all our game-to-game predictions have been pretty terrible. So I'm going to put it to you this way. What's the biggest question for you going into Game 6?
I would say, let's see, biggest question. I mean, Verlander hasn't won a clincher yet this postseason. So he pitched on short rest game 4 against the Rays, didn't get it done. Pitched game 5 at Yankee Stadium for the clincher, didn't get it done. Can he get it done tonight? Does he have enough gas in the tank is the question. If I can give another one, I want to know, does Daniel Hudson have any gas left in the tank? I think he threw like 36 pitches the other day. That's going to be an important piece, I would think, tonight.
Yeah, and I'll get back to Daniel Hudson in a moment. Just to follow up on Verlander, for me, the biggest question is him in the first inning. The numbers are incredible from this postseason. His ERA in the first inning, 16.20. All other innings, 1.78. Opponent batting average in the first inning, 417. All other innings, 170. OPS, almost 800 points higher allowed in the first inning. When you played, was there always that perception with guys like Verlander, power pitchers, that the first inning was maybe your best chance to get a guy like that?
Yeah, I mean, typically there's a narrative there that we've always heard, hey, if you're going to get a guy like this, you got to get him early before he settles in, because if he does, you're going to look up, it's going to be the seventh inning. There are going to be a lot of zeros on the board. And, you know, I don't know, Buster, you know how it is in baseball. You know, we put things out there that we feel, or it seems to be, you know, a pattern. But that's what I would say, you know, when you're looking at a guy like Verlander, and obviously the numbers here is postseason definitely back that up. Whatever it is, whether it's the power pitcher, and hey, I got to come out, I'm going to throw my fastball. And as a hitter, that's exactly what you want. Even, you know, with the velocity that's, you know, mid-90s and a little bit above, in this day and age, guys can handle that. And if they're going to get somewhat of a steady diet of those pitches, then yeah, then you want to go for it. And I was looking last night just at Verlander and, you know, pitch usage as, you know, he goes through the order and everything else. And definitely the last time against this team, I mean, he was fastball heavy early, but then went to, you know, the curveball, breaking ball later on. And, you know, only gave up a couple of runs in the first. That was better than the outing against the Yankees, right? But, you know, he made an adjustment. He got better his last time out in the first inning. So perhaps he'll be a little bit better. That obviously, that seventh inning was stunning. The fact that he was cruising, two runs through six, and then the seventh, the wheels just came off. And how much of that was a change of catchers, because Kyle Tucker pinch hit for Chirinos in the bottom of the sixth, and then we had Maldonado in the seventh, and, you know, is that what happened? We don't know, but this game is a game of adjustments, and he's made a lot of them over the years, and we'll see what he makes tonight, especially in the first inning.
I think your point also about sort of how much gas left in the tank at the end of the season is a good one. You know, the other day when we were in Dave Martinez's office, and I asked him, because this was, I think it was going into game 4, and I asked him, in part because I saw what Alex Cora did in last year's World Series about using, you know, starting pitchers out of the bullpen. I asked him if he had thoughts of using Strasburg out of the bullpen that night. And he gave me a look like, what are you, crazy? I think that maybe, you know, because, of course, these guys, the managers, have a lot more information about how physically tired the pitchers are than we do. You know, they're hearing directly from their athletic trainers. They're having conversations with the starting pitchers. They're aware of some of the analytics on spin rate. And it's the underrated part of starting pitchers at this time of year. One of the great stories I remember about that was, you know, we saw Madison Bumgarner in 2014 have one of the most incredible postseason runs where he just stoically kept taking the ball. He threw over 50 innings. I think it was 52 and a third innings. And when it was over, Bruce Bochy, his manager, who had been going to him time after time after time, looked at him when they're hugging in the celebration line. Okay, now you can tell me, how do you feel? And Bumgarner just looked at him and said, man, I am exhausted. Physically worn down. You know, that, it's a great question going into this game, not only for Verlander, but for Strasburg.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing with you, these conversations that we're so privileged to have these intimate conversations with each skipper before the game. But, you know, when Dave Martinez talked about, you know, and I think I asked him, hey, how did you get the buy-in from these guys? Or what was that, you know, conversation like? How did you go about it? He said, well, they brought, you know, each guy in, you know, individually, had a conversation, wanted to see where they were at with working out of the bullpen. And he said all of them, you know, had buy-in. Now, Strasburg hasn't done it since the division series, right? And I just kind of wonder, you know, to your point of, would he have pitched in game five or pitched, you know, in short rest or out of the bullpen or anything like that? We know going back to 2012, we know he's a Boris guy, right? And, you know, there's that possibility of opting out of the contract. And, you know, whether that was one of those things where, okay, hey, did in the division series, that was it. You know what I mean? It's capped off. We're not going there anymore. Maybe from Strasburg camp or just whatever. And maybe that's something behind closed doors that they know isn't really an option. But yeah, I would say the physical toll, but the mental. I mean, we talk about this game being such a high percentage mental. And when you're trying, when you're pitching this deep into a season of just facing big league hitters, like that's one thing itself, a regular season, you get to the end of the tape. But now you're into an extra month in October and you're facing, you know, the best players, you know, the best lineups. And, you know, I've always said it, you know, this postseason, especially having the Yankees and the Astros, you know, how mentally exhausting it has to be for opposing pitchers, no matter who you are, like going through that lineup two, three times, because you rarely have any breaks, if at all. So, yeah, I would say the one thing that we tend to overlook as well is how much mental energy it takes. I mean, look at the wristbands, look at, you know, the pitchers that will take off their cap and look at their scouting report or outfielders. There's so much information, and you are required to, like, know it because you either have it on your body somewhere or there's someone in the dugout after every inning kind of telling you. So I think you factor all that in there, and man, it is a grueling season.
Now, you made reference to the decision to allow Daniel Hudson to throw 36 pitches in game five when the Nationals were down by multiple runs. I know you guys talked about that night and you were surprised.
Yeah, I was. I think it was one of those things. I'm just going to speculate. But one of those things where, hey, the game's getting away from you. You're at the point. There were some issues that, you know, the Nationals, they had with Lance Barksdale, the umpire. So there was a lot, I think, kind of going on. And I personally almost feel that Dave Martinez maybe just forgot a little bit that Daniel Hudson was in the situation that he was in, and let him go a little longer, you know, than he would have if he had the time to, like, slow everything down or take a step back. Like, no, I got to get this guy out of here. I got to get Suero in or whoever. Because, one, just looking at it, he was in there a hitter or two too long. And it definitely, I think, was it Springer that hit the homer off of him, or was it
yes.
Correa?
Yep. Springer.
Okay, so even before that, you know, he threw a pitch, and I think he walked a guy. And after he delivered the pitch, he just kind of, like, you know, looked down into the bullpen. You know, and you don't see pitchers look down in the bullpen unless they're looking for, hey, you know, I need some help here. You know, what's going on? And so I saw him look down in the bullpen as he was kind of taking his left turn to circle the mound, go back up or whatever. And then the next guy, you know, hits the homer, and it was like, hits the homer, kind of finishes down the mound and he looks into the dugout. And I thought the look into the dugout was like, man, what are we doing here? Like, you know, you got to get me out. You left me in here. You've left me in here too long. And so that's the interpretation that I saw from body language. Maybe we find out a little bit today or not, but you know, with the day off, you know, Daniel Hudson's going to be a free agent as well. I'm sure that's not, you know, for the team and for him personally is not where he wanted to be in that game. But again, you know, here we are, you got max two games left, and I'm sure guys are, you know, digging a little bit deeper, seeing, you know, especially since the odds are against the Nationals, just the hope, keeping hope alive. I'm going to lay everything on the line that I possibly got.
I got three more for you. Give me 30 seconds on each of these. The question of Max Scherzer and whether or not he's going to pitch in Game 7, I'm completely listening to him. Whatever he tells me, I'm going to follow his directive because he's earned that credibility because he was honest with the team before Game 5 and telling them, look, I just can't pitch. What would you do if you're in Dave's situation?
I would say really gathering. And, you know, they've had this back in September they dealt with. But even with Max, he may come in and say, I can go. And I still think Dave's going to really take information in from the trainers, the doctors, and everyone, and might even overrule that in this situation. Because although you know the guys, his attitude, his, like, dedication, everything is there, but you don't want to allow him to go out there and embarrass himself in a game. And, you know, and it just be awful. So I think that there'll be a little more caution with Dave Martinez beyond what Max Scherzer tells him.
30 seconds on this. Why is George Springer so good in the World Series?
I don't know. It's so funny. Like, I just kind of get a smile on my face because this guy is like, I love it because it's almost kind of like he's a mess, right? I mean, he's got AJ picking his bats. He's got wearing Michael Brantley jersey in the clubhouse, you know, before the game. It's like he's – the other day, Buster, I don't know if you saw this or not, but he was walking through the clubhouse. It was in the championship series against the Yankees, and they had lost. And he's walking through in Houston here with, like, sage, and he's burning sage, and he's, like, sprinkling it around the clubhouse. He's like, I got to get the bat out. I got to get the bat out of here. I mean, I just think he's – a fun mess, and he's very talented. So, you know, how it exactly happens, I have no idea. But when you're that talented, it's inevitable.
And last one, give me a player who's jumped out at you in this World Series. For me, it would be Joe Smith. You know, so happy this guy's got such a long history in baseball. He's now right on the cusp of getting his first championship ring. You know, and in this World Series, three innings, no runs allowed, four strikeouts, just one run and eight and a third innings in this postseason. Give me a player who's jumped out at you.
Okay. Will Harris has been outstanding. And, I mean, you talk about whatever your favorite insurance company is. I mean, that's like, can't just put his face on it. If you've got, like, no worries, no concerns, anything happens, your home, auto, whatever, you know, your assets. Will Harris. Also, I got to say, Yuli Gurriel's defense for me has been something that has been very impressive.
Yeah, I've been surprised at how great he's moved around, and I understand why AJ Hinch now has been so complimentary of that. All right, Singale, see you at the ballpark.
Okay, and I'll see you at yoga here in about 30 minutes.
Yeah, no chance.
Namaste.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, some Bleacher Tweets here on this Game 6 day. First one here comes from Brian Simpson at bsimp120274. This is something I've been wondering as well. Hey, Buster, should potential Gerrit Cole suitors be concerned about the wear and tear and stress the postseason has had on him?
I don't think just from the postseason, but part of the reason why you've seen teams steer away from these massive investments in starting pitching is because they are concerned about the innings piled up before they sign a player. And it's one of the great unknowns that teams have in these situations, you know, how much of that is a factor. Now, we have, you know, through history, seen a lot of cases where a big contract for a starting pitcher hasn't paid off. But then you look at someone like a Max Scherzer. Like, that one's been a really good contract for the Nationals. There have been other examples of that. Justin Verlander, obviously, is holding up well through his contract. So it'll be very interesting to see exactly, you know, if some teams decide, you know what, a 7 or 8 year investment in him is just something too scary for them to take on.
Right. It's always like a tightrope between paying for past performance and how much you can get out of the future. So we'll see what happens there. Next one here from Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit. Does leaving Daniel Hudson in for 36 pitches while down 4 runs limit his availability for the Nationals in Game 6, or is the day off still make him fully available?
I think he'll be somewhat limited, and we heard Dan Shulman talk about this on the podcast on Monday. I know that he and Chris Singleton talked about it during the game on Sunday night, that they thought that Daniel Hudson was left in for too long, and you do wonder, especially at a time when the Nationals aren't sure exactly where their pitching is going to be coming from, where the relief is going to be coming from, if there'll be some regrets that they allowed him to throw that many pitches.
Mike P. at MPresco1, do you think the World Series has been kind of boring this year? Compared to the Indians and Cubs series we saw a few years ago, that series felt more intense, whereas these games haven't been close.
Yeah, I'd co-sign that. I think within the games, not only have some of the games not been close, but the pace. I mean, they have to find a way to improve the pace, because it feels like just about every game, not game five, but most of the games have been 4 hours, and they have to get that down, because I just don't think you're going to really draw in a generation of fans, especially 15-year-olds like my son, when your games take that long.
I agree. Yeah, right now the legacy of this series is electronic strike zones, and maybe like the most compelling moment or most memorable moment off the top of my head is Alex Bregman taking a 28-second lap around the bases on a home run. So you got to have those moments.
I thought you were going to talk about the two women flashing behind home plate, Troy. When you started that, I didn't know if that was going to be your most compelling moment.
I didn't see that. I listened to the games. I don't really watch them, Buster. So unfortunately, I missed that part of it. Next one here from CrossFit School of Sweat. That's School of Sweat. Is the rush to get pitchers into the bigs to get as much out of their initial service time ultimately hurting development of better quality second, third, and fourth pitches, which in turn is limiting their ability to get through a lineup a third or fourth time?
Yeah, School of Sweat, you're onto something. No question about it. Look, I don't think that you're seeing young pitchers trained to pitch deep into games, and throw 6 or 7 or 8 innings in the way that we did for generations. And there's some logic behind that, and there's logic behind protecting starting pitchers when they're younger. But the fact is, it's part of the reason why we're seeing this parade of relievers.
Next one from Houston Ken at Houston Ken. Buster, who will accomplish more in their career, Juan Soto or Yordan Alvarez?
I'm taking Juan Soto. First off, I always think that while you certainly have had some examples of excellent DHs in baseball history, Edgar Martinez, David Ortiz, you're always taking the guy who's got a place in the field. And Juan Soto is not a good outfielder now, but he's okay. And I think he'll get better as his career goes along, and that guy is a monster offensive player for someone that young.
Final tweet this morning from MLBNLT at MLBNLT1. Longtime listener from Lithuania. And he says, a path is now worn from the ESPN booth to front office and to manager. I know you're biased, Buster, but what about Jess Mendoza as the first female manager in the MLB?
Nope, not going to happen. And I tell you why, because I just think that if you're going to be a manager in a major league dugout, you have to have some history working in the dugout. For example, Dan Jennings had so many years in baseball as a scout, as a front office member with the Miami Marlins. And for some reason, he was put in that job as manager. And right away, you'd hear stories about the players just didn't look at him as someone with credibility. If you dropped in a knucklehead like me, even if I was the smartest, knew more about baseball than anybody else in the world, you're not going to drop a sports writer in the dugout because you don't have the credibility, the history of working in the dugout. And I think that would be the same case with Jess. Now, if she were to pursue a path and become a coach and then have time in the dugout, then maybe that could change. But, part of the reason why David Ross, Alex Cora, Aaron Boone, Eduardo Perez are in these conversations is because, of course, for years they've had time in the dugout. And I do think that in terms of perception of the players, that's really important.
As you were answering that question, I was picturing you in your little manager uniform running out of the dugout and throwing
right.
bases across the field, Lou Piniella style.
It would be laughable. That would be laughable if I were to do that, right?
It would be. I can only hope so.
It would be awful. I know. That's what I'm saying. I mean, it would be a joke if I were ever to become a manager, me in that position.
Thank you for the tweets this morning. keep them coming every day. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets. And we talked a lot today about this electronic strike zone. There's a new ESPN Daily podcast episode all about it today with Mina Kimes, Jeff Passan. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's it for today. My thanks to Sarah Langs, to Tim Kirchin, to Chris Singleton, and to Troy Farkas, who produces this podcast every day. Enjoy Game 7 tonight, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.